I came up with this episode because recently I was having a conversation with someone and we were discussing what black culture means. Safe to say we didn't exactly come to a conclusion by the end of it, but it had me thinking. The term black has evolved over the years. In fact, in Britain, there was a time where it was a political term that African, Caribbean, and South Asian people bandied behind. Today, black encompasses, to me at least, a universal connection around the world that mostly derives from the impact of transatlantic slavery, both in how it broke African communities and the legacy it holds over the histories of black people in Europe and the Americas. I don't mean this to say that slavery is the start of our stories, but its legacy is a language we all have to live with. Sometimes I think of being black as being part of a giant family who shares similar stories, but who might speak in different tongues or deviated down different paths. I think of the Jollof Wars and how if you say anything else but Senegalese Jollof, it's called Benetton by the way, is the best, then you're wrong. But I also think about how African American dishes like gumbo remind me of supper, which I grew up eating in my Gambian household. If you grew up in Britain like me, you'll be familiar with how hard it can be to grapple with race in this country. Growing up, most black representation I was exposed to came through African American music videos and films. Heck, even the little black history I was taught in school focused on civil rights figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. Both great men, but there was no mention of Ignatius Sancho or Oluwadu Equiano, and very little of any black British female figures. Well, actually, tell a lie. I did learn about Mary Seacole in year 5, so shout out her. Even the term black British is complicated, and it's something that I only use now because it's the easiest way to encompass all of the identities, both Caribbean and African, that I want to talk about without listing every country on the continent and every island in the West Indies. I've never called myself English, and I never will, but black British, I can kind of get behind. Anyway, as a result of both the popular culture and school, most of what I recognised to be universally black was African American culture. And this is something I think most people can relate to. There was this weird juxtaposition between what I experienced in my household and what was presented in the media as being black with a capital B. Luckily, I think we now live in a time where black culture is as complicated as it should be. Something hard to define and something we don't need to. It is Afrobeats, soca, grime, and hip-hop. It is laughter, joy, and warmth. It is solidarity and exchange. So, let's get into it. Hello, and welcome to The Nerd Alternative, a sweet melting pot of all things nerdy. I am your host, Ram, and today we have a special, kind of a familiar guest, actually. We have a special guest. We have Brendan. Hello, Brendan, who is in like a Zen mood?
It's the voice always. The voice always. It's so calming.
Thanks.
I'm just a nasally American. hi guys. I'm Brendan.
Welcome to this special episode. Today we are doing a bit of a cultural exchange. And this is an episode that we've been talking about for like a really long time.
I was walking home from the supermarket to do this show, and I thought I literally announced this with you. What was it? Shang-Chi came out in 2021, right?
Yes.
Like you and I did that collaboration, like in September. And I think I announced that at the end of the show. So this is literally almost 2.5 years in the making.
Yeah. So it's gonna be a good one. I feel like, you know, it's been marinating basically. Sure. We'll call it marinating as opposed to delayed. But I feel like, you know, it happened when it was supposed to happen. Yeah, I remember like when I came, I did specifically have you in mind when I thought about this episode, because I think just like, if you don't know, Brendan was the host of Blurred Up, which is a podcast that, yeah, we just really enjoy. And I think whenever I used to listen to Blurred Up, I think I was really just struck by, first of all, how eloquent you are generally just like speaking about things, but also just like the cultural depth and like analysis that you had, especially when you talked about like hip hop and things like that, and just that aspect of the culture really stood out to me. So I think when I was thinking about this episode, I was like, oh, this would be so sick to do with you. I'm excited that we're finally here. Before we kind of get a bit more into it, I just wanted to explain the episode. So I decided to pitch a bit of a cultural exchange episode between myself and Brendan, where we were tasked with picking three different things that felt quintessentially Black British or quintessentially African American. Obviously, this is like our interpretation, and this does not mean that it is completely representative of both of those like cultures, but it was kind of about just like having a conversation across the diaspora about the way that we experience race in our individual like countries / upbringings and what that looks like in our medium. So we picked a film, a song, and a person that we felt like kind of captured that. Yeah, I feel like I picked those mediums because they're quite different, but also quite easy for us to watch / listen to / research. But also I think that is like, you know, film and particularly music. I think music was quite important to pick, is like something that Black cultures around the world kind of share. There's this sense of like musicality. But before we get into our picks, I wanted to ask the... Okay, so this is quite like a big question. I don't know if it's a big question. I guess it's more of a complicated question. But what does Black culture mean to you? / does it mean anything to you?
I mean, it definitely means something to me. it means a lot to me because, for those who don't know, I'm still living in South Korea. And so what is the big cultural export? K-pop is probably the biggest at this time. And, you know, it is sometimes wild. I'm not really like, I don't hear K-pop all the time, but when I see some videos or see, you know, advertisements on YouTube, et cetera, and you're seeing these guys in the army camo jacket and pants and Timberland boots. And it's like, if, you know, who's the BTS? I mean, I don't know these names. Jimin, I guess. If Jimin's walking down the street in those clothes, the girls are going to be like, oh my God, you know, yeah, Hollering for this guy. But if I did it, there's going to be some, a different reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, so cultural appropriation, just kind of gatekeeping that in a sense too. I've thought about that more as I've grown up in this country. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, what is Black culture? I mean, because then it comes down to like, what is Black too, right? Because there's what it means to be Black in different countries. There's also mixed ethnicities, right? What does it mean to be Black and Hispanic or Black and Asian, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. I don't really know how to answer that question. I mean, culture created, forged within Black communities or within Black individuals that, you know, became popular within that culture. Yeah. I mean, that's
I feel like that's a pretty good answer for the fact that I sprung the question on you, because I think I thought about this for a long time and I still don't have a answer myself. I think sometimes when you're on social media and stuff, there's a tendency to generalize Black as a term, and I've always found that a little bit problematic sometimes. I guess more so in when people will throw out like Black culture as something being associated with maybe something that is more negative. So like if it's, you know, gang crime, it'll be like, but that's part of our culture. And it's like, I don't know, sometimes there's a tendency to to kind of overlap things that I think are not necessarily, like, there might be a lot of Black people participating in a certain thing, but that doesn't make it quintessentially Black. Yeah, so I think I've kind of grappled with that term a little bit. And I think as a Black British person, for a long time, Black culture was mostly African-American culture in our kind of growing up. And I think we didn't really particularly like clock that or realize that until we started developing our own like Black British culture and like until, you know, something like Afrobeats came out. And then it's like, oh, wait, hang on. Like, it's a lot bigger than that. And, you know, there's a bit of diaspora wars that happens all the time, like online or like in real life, that I think also comes back to like, what is Black culture and why are we kind of putting ourselves in a box when being Black is such a global thing and we are all over the place and we all have very like different histories and different experiences. But I think what you said about forging, I feel like that gives it a more general term and like a kind of like overview of all of the cultures that I'm talking about, which I quite like as a definition.
Just to go off your point, you know, I'm kind of jumping ahead to Cornel West, but he was one of the first, I think the first person where I read you know, just about how race is a social construct, you know, before white people called us black and themselves white, they didn't call themselves that, right? They were Irish or British or, you know, Spanish or whatever. And then for us too, like we weren't just black people. We were, you know, various tribes and et cetera. So I think what you're doing with this show is interesting. I think it's part of a trend of people not just saying I'm black American, but really finding their roots and saying, no, I'm Nigerian American, or I am, you know, Gandhian American or whatever that, I don't know what is it? Is it Ghanaian? Ghanaian? Anyway, you know, because you have people even within the black community, your Drakes who are not from a certain culture, but, you know, jacking that culture for, you know, for his own gain and profit. So, you know, really drawing that demarcation line about what is what, you know, and celebrating that. I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like there's a lot to say about this. Basically, when I was doing my dissertation and doing research for my dissertation, I actually learned that, like, in this country, in Britain, that black used to be more of a political term. So it did actually include, like, people who were, like, South Asian, as well as, like, people who are Caribbean or, like, African and stuff. And so I think ever since learning that, even that term is just like, oh, like, you know, it's so fluid. And like you said, racism is a construct. It's interesting to see how it's kind of evolved from that time period all the way to now and what we think of when we say black.
That's interesting because on the other side of the pond there, people, even in the black community, but I've heard it from white, either movies or stuff, but like even the N-word has been used to talk about those people, like a sand nigger would be a Middle Eastern person, right? So that's interesting.
There is definitely like a generation where black was more of a almost a call to action, I suppose, in terms of like how you get treated in this country. Moving on, so I want to go over why you picked the film that you picked.
So I chose X, or Malcolm X. I think it's just called X, right? I'm pretty sure I watched this movie after I read the book. And I read the book the early 2010s or something like that, while I was in Korea. Part at home. I bought it at an airport on the way either back to Korea or to America, and then I read it. Anyway, it really changed my life. First of all, you know, I think just like a lot of black people, not only America, but maybe abroad, but maybe it's acute in America, because I think you talked about how when you were in school, you were taught about Martin Luther King Jr. a lot. And for us, it was the same. Malcolm X was largely kind of cut out. Mm-hmm. And I think it was because of his radicalism. I mean, of course, Martin Luther King was a radical as well. But I think Malcolm X, is his by any means necessary, was largely pushed out of, you know, mainstream education. And so for me, I actually had a negative view of him for a time. That, you know, his by any means meant violence. And, you know, as a kid, you know, growing up, that's not the right way to achieve peace and in equality, only to realize that historically, that's just not how that works. Mm-hmm. So reading that book gave me a deeper understanding about him. And Cornel West in his Race Matters book name dropped him a bit. And so that also pushed me, like I graduated from Cornel West to go read about Malcolm X. And so, yeah, this movie, it's the first Spike Lee film I've ever watched all the way through. I haven't really watched a lot of his films, sorry. Wow.
I have actually watched a lot of Spike Lee films, but I just like, I don't love all of them. So I tend to avoid talking about Spike Lee in general. But yeah, when we get into the movie, I was quite surprised. Anyway, I'll let you carry on.
I love the book, and I was like, okay, I got to watch this movie because, you know, this is Denzel Washington in arguably his prime. I think most people say this is his best performance. And I would not disagree with that. This is a stellar cast. Angela Bassett, of course, you know, she's always excellent. Is this movie quintessentially American, like African-American? I mean, it could go so many routes, but there's jazz in this movie, very African-American music. Just the struggle, I think, of not this black, you know, this kind of modern black capitalist bootstraps. I was poor and now I'm rich, but more of like, I bucked the pressures of the system that was trying to kill me. I mean, he was killed eventually, but essentially at a young age, of to kill me or to keep me ignorant and to push all that off and become so intelligent, eloquent, and so influential and positive. Mm-hmm. That's just an incredible story. And I can't think of another like Hollywood production that portrays that in the African-American space. But I could be wrong. But
I mean, I'm not going to be like the voice of authority on this because I wouldn't know. But like, I think, yeah, after I watched it, I was like, oh, this is such a good choice. And I think also Spike Lee, even the story of like how Malcolm X was finished ultimately, I feel like also kind of adds to the African-Americanness of it, I suppose. So like Spike Lee talked about how I think Warner Bros. Had given them a certain like budget for the film, and he was going over. He contributed like some of his own salary to it, and he wanted to make the movie longer, and they basically had to stop production because they were refusing to put any more money into it. And so he kind of rounded, like called round to all these like rich African-American figures like Oprah. I can't remember who the whole list was, but it was like quite a few names that you would know, and basically like fundraised to be able to finish the rest of the movie. So it's like without them, the movie wouldn't even finish. And I think that's just, I don't know, I think that kind of adds to just the whole legacy of the movie. I don't necessarily think this is a good thing, but I think in Britain, we don't really have like we do have some black middle class members, but there's not really that almost like support group, I would say. I think we're kind of guessing that now, of like having artists who are able like to collaborate with each other and like have that kind of pool where it's like, actually, we can all fundraise to make sure that this movie happens. Let's talk about the movie though. I guess for me, I hadn't read Malcolm X's book before, so all of this was like, I knew about him as a figure, and yeah, like you said, like Malcolm X was not, he was kind of a bit of a footnote, I suppose, in our history lessons, where it was like, oh, there was Martin Luther King, and also there was this guy called Malcolm X around the same time. He was kind of like, you know, it was almost that like Magneto Xavier like comparison. That's how they presented it in school, which obviously those two were inspired by the two of them.
That's what's crazy, because as a kid, you know, I'm watching, you know, the X-Men came out. Malcolm X, the movie, came out, was it 92?
Yes, I was going to say 93, but that might have just been me.
Yeah, I could be wrong, but yeah, I want to say 92. The X-Men animated series also came out around that time. And at the time, as a kid, I'm starting to learn about African-American history. So when you're watching the X-Men, you're seeing Magneto just not sit on the sidelines. He's just going out to kill people, you know, like he's just setting on the world. And I'm like, is that how Malcolm was? Because I was kind of hearing that comparison back in the day. And I'm like thinking like, this guy is, maybe he had good intentions, a killmonger, if you will, but he went off the rails. That's kind of how I was seeing him for a long time. And I think a lot of black people for a time thought that was just, he was too radical. He was too aggressive. But reading the book and clearly watching the film, it wasn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think when I watched the film, because I hadn't watched, and that's how I knew I didn't know that much about Malcolm X, because I didn't know anything about his past. Like, I didn't know that he had gone to jail. I didn't know that he was like committing crime. Like, so I was so, for the first half of the movie, I was sitting there like, what? I was so confused.
Am I in the right film?
Yeah, I literally had a moment of like, I was like, well, I know this is Malcolm X, but I was like, is it though? I was like, is this true? Like, so I think for me, it was a bit of like a learning experience, I suppose, because I learned a lot. The things that kind of stood out to me was, again, like some of the things that you mentioned that are quintessentially African-American, I guess, or like related to African-American culture, which was like the music and the jazz and like the dancing. But then also just thinking about like the civil rights movement and how Malcolm's journey and how he got there in general, and seeing someone who went to jail and then had his mind open. But also, I think for me, seeing what the Nation of Islam did to him, and that kind of almost like infighting as well, it was something that, like, I don't think that's necessarily like African-American. I think that is like a wider conversation, maybe amongst different black cultures, where I do sometimes think, like, you know, even when we have the diaspora wars, when it's like, we should all kind of be on the same side, like, why are we letting this little thing kind of like distract us from the greater cause? And that kind of like jealousy, or like crabs in the barrel almost like mentality, I suppose, that came up in the film was also something that struck me, because it was really sad, actually, and just like made me feel really, just, it was almost worse than, I mean, it did feel worse to know that he'd been betrayed by people that he, you know, a group that he was once a part of. And I, like,
It be your own niggas.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, the trad. I didn't want to say that, but
yeah. It's a black show. I don't really say that word, but I'm a say that. Yeah. I'm gonna say that line because it's definitely applicable here.
Yeah, I think the tragedy of that is something that
in front of his kids too.
Yeah,
That's crazy.
Oh. That was actually one of the scenes actually that Spike Lee showed clips from like his films and stuff. And that last scene of Malcolm being assassinated was one of the scenes that he showed. And I think it's probably, I got the impression that it was like his favorite thing that he's ever done. That might not be true, but I think.
That scene or the movie, you mean?
I think the movie, but that particular scene, kind of the lead up to Malcolm being distracted and almost like knowing that he was going to die. So I think he said when he spoke to Bessie, like she had said to Spike Lee that like she felt as though Malcolm knew that day he was going to die. So that's why the whole film was shot in that way of like him having this almost like, I don't know, it was weird because I don't think it was like paranoia, but it was almost like there's this like melancholy to him, and which was almost like frustrating because I was like, just don't go, like just don't. But yeah, just talking about like how he filmed that process and
him kind of like it was at the very end, he was going to the building, he was like, yeah, had that floating shot of him not walking, but he's floating. Yeah. He'd already kind of, I don't know, accepted that, yeah, that he was a ghost, or yeah, or you know, he was, you know, on that conveyor belt to death, maybe, in a sense.
Yeah.
And then even in the movie, I had to go back to it a couple times watching it a few weeks ago. But right as the guys pulled up with the gun, he like kind of cracked a smile at it. And I was like, was this a blooper that they didn't edit? Or like, do you think he really did that? Did maybe even the wife see him do this and put it in the film? I'm very curious about that. I would love to ask Spike Lee about that. Smiling at your assailants. That's an interesting choice.
Mm-hmm. I did come away from, also the movie is quite long, but it never felt long. And I think that's just kind of a testament, well, to Denzel Washington, the fact that he's just really captivating to watch, but also the story of the man. And I feel like they captured everything that they needed to capture in it. I think sometimes, especially with like films, like biopics that are, I don't want to say Oscar bait, I always find them really boring and just really tedious and almost just like a bit.
By the numbers sometimes.
Yeah. But this wasn't that. There was a real spirit in it. That I think Spike Lee managed to capture, which left me feeling, obviously you feel like really sad at the end of it, but feeling quite rejuvenated. And I'm glad that I watched it at this age where I am a bit more, I don't want to say radical is the term, but I think I'm a bit more, compared to when I was a child where where I would have had a like different mindset. I think I'm a lot more like critical of like the system and like thinking about, especially when we talk about like, you know, Palestine and Israel in this like day and age, and thinking about like, what does it look like to push back against like systems, and what is the work that actually goes into that? What is the kind of language that you have to use? I think that was something that just really, really struck me as I was watching it.
I think to go back to your point about not knowing what kind of film this was, because as soon as it opens up, it's like, I don't remember if it was him as a kid first or it goes straight to him with the suit on.
Mm-hmm.
And him and Spike Lee are like dancing, snapping, smiling, and just the idea of him not just pushing out the forces that are trying to just kill him from outside, but just pushing out the notion that he has to change his own hair to be considered attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And going from that kind of almost musical-like beginning to that gruesome ending. Yeah, just a phenomenal film. You're right, it is long, but there's no fat at all. Like there's no scene that I would cut. Everything is important.
Yeah.
For sure.
I think the last thing also that I wanted to say is that about Islam and like his religious journey. I think sometimes religion can be portrayed in a bit more of like a negative way, I think, in a lot of mediums. And I think it was quite nice to see how the impact of his like spirituality outside of the Nation of Islam, but like when he actually went to Mecca and stuff, and how that kind of transformed like a lot of his thinking and a lot of his ideas, and like seeing a positive journey. I think also because there's just a lot of Islamophobia both in America and also in Britain in media as well, that was also quite a lovely journey to see.
And among Black people, right?
Yeah.
Like there are how many Black Christians in America and, you know, abroad are like anti, you know, they have some, you know, Islamophobic views, you know, in barbershops joking about, you know, the guy who comes in with the Call magazine or something.
Mm-hmm.
I also, you know, going back to the as a youth, the propaganda around Malcolm X, him being just pro-black and just hating white people. But you see in the book and in the movie how going to Mecca made him more inclusive.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people even today need to remember or learn about, you know, I'm very curious about what kind of coalition he could have amassed had he had been alive longer.
Yeah. I think his relationship, I didn't know that he had been with, I was shocked when I saw, I didn't know that he had been with a white woman. I think because I had just seen that he was, I think a lot of like Malcolm X that I knew about was just very much like while he was in his kind of leadership, like activism. So all of his past stuff really like surprised me, but also even like little moments when the white woman comes up to him and says like, you know, I've been reading about your work and like, what can I do to help the cause? And he says nothing. And I was like, whoa. But yeah, just seeing his like journey. And I think it's really important actually to think about that, like that this is a journey. Like you don't have to have one like political mindset for the rest of your life and that's it. Like there is like, you know, you can take things in and learn and be more inclusive or change. I don't want to say inclusive because that's not necessarily the, but just seeing his journey from like, you know, he had a phase where he was not engaged at all, then he was very pro-black but in a way that was very exclusive, and then at the end it was actually thinking about broadening things out a little bit more. And yeah, like you said, it would have been interesting to see where that would have gone if he was still alive.
I also want to think about what if that person was created today. Right? You have a man who was a drug dealer, hit women, cheated on them, passed over black women for white women, and then some years later he comes out on Twitter or on the YouTube sphere.
Yeah.
And starts talking, he tries to become an FD signifier or something.
Yeah.
You know, reading Bell Hooks, I would have, you know, I'll get to Cornel West. I would have chosen Bell Hooks as my person, but I want to do Cornel West. But just the notion of transformation and forgiveness. There are a lot of things that I feel in the black space, I mean, in any leftist space, but, you know, we're talking specifically about the black space and maybe even more just like the internet, Twittery black space of canceling and forgiveness. I mean, I know like cancel is not real. I'm just saying that just in general, but the idea of not forgiving, I think it's a very like neoliberal capitalist way of like, if he don't act right the first time, just cut him out, just get a new one. And if we keep doing that, if we keep living that way, we can cut out some people who could potentially do some real good in our lives personally or for the community. And so I've always used, ever since I read this book, because I was also like mind blown that he was a drug dealing, you know, violent thug. Yeah. I've tried to incorporate that into all of my relationships, whether it be friendships, you know, romantic ones, especially teaching. You know, how many times have we been at the market and some badass kids like, Mom, I don't want to do this. And you're like, damn, that's a badass kid. And you kind of wonder what he'll grow up into, you know, and you're, you know, as a teacher, you know, you come into a new class and there's that badass kid over there and you want to just rage at them or kind of isolate them. But I always think about him, Malcolm X, and how that kid just with a little support, a little push can become someone really important in that classroom. And every year that is the case. Much love to him and the creators of this movie to help kind of
to bring that up.
Illustrate that.
Yeah. It was a masterpiece. I would recommend everyone to go watch it if you have not watched it, because I can't believe it took me like my whole life to basically to see this film. So the movie that I picked was Rocks, which is a 2019 film that is about a young black British girl who's living in London, who's abandoned by her mum alongside with her young brother. So it's directed by Sarah Gavron and written by Teresa Ikoko and Claire Wilson. But my favorite thing about this film, I kind of watched it before I knew all of the background stuff. And so this is kind of why I picked it, was that the whole film was a collaboration with the teenage cast that they worked with. So Bookie Bakray and Kosar Ali, who are kind of like the breakout stars of the film and have now gone on to be in other films and are quite active in their like acting career. were all non-professional actors. And you could kind of feel that in the film. So I remember when I was watching it, I went to a girls' school when I was growing up, and I kind of like felt that sense of like, oh, this really feels like just some girls in a girls' school, kind of like a lot of the conversations just felt very real. I think there's been like really great movies, like for example, Attack the Block, which I absolutely love as a movie. But sometimes when I was listening to it, and I don't really speak with a lot of slang and stuff, but even watching Attack the Block, I was like, oh, some of the slang is a bit outdated, or it felt a bit stilted, or it felt a little bit unnatural. And it's still like a really great movie, but that was always something in the back of my head. And I think Rocks is a film that I don't feel that at all, where I was like, it almost feels like there's just a camera in this like classroom just following around these like characters, and that there's nothing, that this is not scripted. So I was really like, yeah, and pleased to find out that like they went into schools and they basically did these auditions, and they were really looking for like young people who had not acted professionally before. And there was a lot of collaboration in the script where the young people were kind of like just improvising and riffing and just like having normal conversations. And I think you could really feel that. I think I picked this film because I think Black British culture is a little bit like behind in terms of like African American culture, in terms of like just our own like media, where it's like really informed by like our culture and like having almost like a sense of like unity. And if you go on I will shout this out again later, but if you go on like places like BFI Player, you'll find some like really interesting films like from the 80s and stuff, where like a lot of mostly like Caribbean artists like were starting to like produce films that were telling very specific stories about their kind of journeys in this country and stuff. But I think for me, because I am of a certain age, I wanted to kind of pick a film that really felt like the moment that I felt quite like seen, or moments where I felt like, oh wow, like this is a very specific story that's not necessarily about me, but like this could be about my friend, or this could be about, yeah, someone that I know. And that it just had like a lot of the nuances that I think speak to what it's like being a Black person in Britain. Yeah, that's kind of my pre-ramble. But what did you think of the film?
I mean, there were no lasers in it, so I was kind of like, no, I'm joking. no, but it's like, this year, I really haven't watched a lot of new films. I had only watched, you know, the big blockbusters. So just as soon as the movie starts, the women are on a rooftop. And as you said, the conversation just felt so organic. And I was just taken aback by that. Just in an era where it's just quip scripts, just seeing them just talk and relax. And it, like I said, just the organic nature of the conversation, just it really hit me hard. It's like, oh yeah, these kind of movies exist. These kind of scripts exist. And I'm sure they still do, of course. I think just as a culture, we've been so, what's a big word? Inculcated with this notion of just only going and showing up for the big films. And so that was touching in the very beginning. Of course, also too, like the women themselves, it's like with Malcolm X, you know, Denzel Washington is like, and the 90s was like, you know, the most handsome Black man alive. You know, before Will Smith, right? You know, and so having him, and of course Angela Bassett was fine, like these kind of model looking actors doing this movie, compared to Rocks, where these are just regular women, it just added to the immersion of the film for me, for sure.
Yeah, what you said about, I'm obsessed with films about girlhood. So I think that was also like another element of the film that I really enjoyed, because I think for me, Rocks also kind of like captured, and I think this is almost like a universal thing. I don't think this is just a Black British thing, but I think of like Black women having to like grow up early, or like having to take on certain like roles earlier than they maybe like should have, which I think came across really well in this. But also like the theme of like sisterhood, and like how your friends come together to kind of like help you out in tough situations, even though each of them was a teenage girl, and it's not like there was necessarily something that they could do to bring Rox's mom back, or like to get her out of the situation, but they all did what they could. But I think the part for me that kind of like sticks out as being like Black British was the different kind of cultures that were within the film. And I think there is like, you know, when I grew up, you know, I had a friend who was like Iraqi and British, and like, because here there are a lot of a lot more people who are like first generation immigrants or like second generation immigrants. And so we're kind of just still straddling what it means to be like a British person, because we do feel very British, but at the same time, knowing that, like, you know, when we go home, we're going to eat a certain food, or like, you know, we're going to wear a certain like attire to like a wedding and all that kind of stuff. And so it was like having that melting pot of like when Rox goes to Samaya's house and everyone's in their like Somali attire, and there's going to be like a Somali wedding, and
just,
you know,
the decor was incredible. It was like a whole new world going
in there. Or like her knowing to say like mashallah and all that kind of stuff, and just like having that exchange. I think that's like one of my favorite things about being a Black British person, is that you still, sometimes it can be quite difficult straddling those two like identities, because, you know, you have like a generational gap between maybe you and your parents, where it's like you've grown up here, there are a lot of things about you that are more British, but you also have like other friends who you learn a lot about, like other people's cultures and stuff, and like kind of finding that middle ground. And I think that was something that was really beautiful in Rox. There's like a conversation that happens between, I think it's Agnes, who is the English girl within the friendship group, her saying like, oh, it's so boring being English. And then, you know, one of their Bengali friends being like, Bangladeshi friends being like, well, if you went to like Bangladesh, everyone would be like, oh, you're so cool. But it's just that, you know, we're all in England, so therefore you are kind of like the standard here. So,
sure.
And having those conversations, I think, were really interesting. Was there anything that like surprised you, or you felt you learned about in terms of like Britishness or Black Britishness from the film?
You know, in the nature of what this show is, that cultural exchange, just the opening rooftop scene where they're just kind of joking with each other, and then all of a sudden they pull out Tina Turner, African American, you know, singing icon. In fact, that they're so young and pull out a song from such a long time ago was quite shocking. I didn't see that coming. But as you said, you know, a lot of what quote unquote Black culture is sold across the world, you know, or African American culture is sold as just the default Black culture around the world. So that was interesting. I think how easy Rox got a hotel with her brother. I was like, is that how the culture is there? Is this a plot hole? I was like,
That I'm not sure that I could completely, I guess she was pretending to be her. I think I'd have to go try that out. I did get ID'd for like drain blockage thing the other day. So
what does that mean?
You get that stuff to like when your drains are blocked, and you get that liquid that you can pour down. It's not bleach, but it's kind of like a bleach.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I got ID'd for that the other day.
Oh,
so,
you get ID'd?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I would assume, yeah, a 10-year-old couldn't just go to a Walmart and pick up Drano. Yeah, as opposed.
I don't think I look like a 10-year-old, but like, so I'm like, I don't know how, like if someone ID'd me for that, I would assume that they'd be a bit more rigorous about the ID process in a hotel. But I can't confirm or deny if that is a plot hole or not, but maybe it did seem like a shoddy hotel though, so I don't know.
Yes. I gave it a pass, but I was like, that's interesting. You know, there's also the Rox was like, you know, so friendly with her mates, and then she just starts stealing and got very confrontational with the Somalian woman. It's like, at first I was like, this feels like a hard turn, like a very scripted hard turn. Mm-hmm. But I also think about when I was in high school and I had some friction with my friends over some small stuff too. You know, it's the hormones, of course. Mm-hmm. Was it, you know, egos, hormones? I mean, this young woman is up against a lot right now, and so I gave a slight kind of side eye at, this feels like very scripted. But I was like, you know what, I can see this happening. You're either with me or against me. It's fight or flight at that moment, right?
Yeah.
It's because it's me and my brother that I have to take care of. So I dig it.
Yeah. I think I don't know if you've ever watched Top Boy, like the pre-Drake, sorry, no shade to Drake, but the pre-Drake kind of season. So Summer House in particular. Have you watched that?
I feel like I watched Top Boy for like 5 minutes before I had to like leave the house, and I never like came back to it. It's on Netflix, right?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I think you can find the original like Summer House ones, but I think something else that kind of struck me about Rox that I felt was more kind of went away from a narrative that we're a bit more used to seeing within like Black British like theatre, but also like films, was that so in Summer House, if I remember correctly, if I'm wrong, please nobody like come for me. This, I have not watched that season ages ago, but there is a storyline where one of the young people has a similar situation to Rox, where his mother like abandons him and he kind of like is trying to avoid being put in the care system and like is basically covering for his mom and the fact that his mom has disappeared. And within that, it kind of goes in a separate direction where he gets a bit more involved in like drugs and like crime and all that kind of stuff. And I think there are a lot of like narratives that are like quite similar to that. And I know that's something that happens in real life, but I think it was quite refreshing in Rox that it didn't go completely a hard left. Like obviously she did steal, she got into a bit of like trouble, she was a bit misguided, but at the end of it, like there was still this kind of like full circle moment where she came back to her friends and they were still there to support her, and she kind of like seeked her the support systems she has. Obviously with the way that the movie ends, we don't know if that's gonna be the way that her story ends necessarily, because we don't know if her mom's coming back, her brother's in care, she's in care, right. And that might, you know, that might be the path that it leads down. But I think it was quite encouraging, I think, for me not to see the same narrative played out over and over again, because I think, I guess I can speak more to like theater. I went to drama school and I remember we had like a session where we had a bit of like a debate about one of our like theater critics was basically saying like, I'm tired of seeing the same Black struggle narrative in our theater plays, which is all very the same story. And I think we did have to get that out of our system, because I think for a long time we didn't really have a lot of representation on screen, but then all of a sudden all these plays that were being funded were the same kind of stories of like young kid on the block, missing parents, they get into trouble, blah blah blah, and it's just rinse and repeat. And I think now that we've had like more conversations across the board just about Black media in general, about like, you know, this trauma porn narrative and stuff, and like how do you tell those stories and like acknowledge that pain and acknowledge that there are like, you know, certain sad stories or like stories that hurt, and give people that catharsis without necessarily just repeating the same story and not having those nuances. And I think that's what's really nice about Rox, is that there's a lot of pain and you feel a lot of sadness, and that this young girl is like having to shoulder so much, but at the same time there's like moments where you're just like laughing out loud because her and her friends, and there's like so many moments of just like levity that I think in general speak to the Black experience as a whole. But even like just being Black British, like yeah, there are moments that are like really hard, but also, you know, that there's a sense of having community, of like having your friends, of like having, you know, we're not crying every single day because life is so hard, like, you know, you have these moments of joy and growth. And yeah, I think that was, it's definitely in my like top 10 favorite movies. I cry every single time that I watch it, but I think it's that comes back to me all the time.
Yeah, I like the ending where, you know, you contrast the beginning where they're all so joyous, and Rox included, you know, she's like trying to rap and, you know, on the rooftop. And then at the end they're, you know, in the restaurant, they're on the beach, and you see everyone is having a good time, and she's just dead inside. You know, and then finally, you know, I don't know her name, but the smiley lady sees her struggling and just like, you know, come here, and just like gives her that shoulder to cry on. And it's like, you know, reading Bell Hooks and just thinking about masculinity, toxic patriarchy. And it's like, man, how many times would that have been great for me, you know, in high school, where, you know, you see that so common in women's spaces. So that's I was just beautiful to see again.
And I think my final point on this movie, just because I think, was also that there was, I think the moment where she goes to stay with Agnes, who is her white friend, and Agnes basically, like, you kind of see a comparison of her going to stay with Sameo, who is her Somali friend, who is like, you know, I think you should probably tell someone about this, but she doesn't go to the police, she doesn't go to, like, the care system and phone them up. And then you see that comparison with Agnes, who is her white friend, who, you know, also equally wants to help her out, but in her head, that is the best thing to do. And, you know, that leads to Rox being separated. And for her, that is like a massive betrayal. And Agnes does come back into the fold, but you can tell that, you know, there is something damaged within their relationship. And there's almost like a sense of mistrust. I don't know quite how to articulate this. And I've always thought about that moment a lot, but I think in And again, I don't think this is uniquely like a Black British problem necessarily, but I think sometimes thinking about like being somewhat a person of color, particularly a Black person, having white friends and sometimes not kind of knowing whether they fully like get you, I suppose, or like, you know, there's a completely different like cultural understanding. Objectively, you can kind of look at it like, you know, Rox cannot carry on this way, but there is a big betrayal in her doing that. Like that is almost not, and yeah, I still don't know where I stand with that because, you know, that is eventually where Rox was going to end up. But I think there's that, yeah, there's that sense of like misunderstanding. And again, like I keep referring to things, but I went to an event with RF Kuang recently, and in her book Babel, she writes about a similar relationship with a white friend who just doesn't seem to understand her friends of color and kind of has this like, she loves them, but at the same time, just there's this like complete disconnect. And I think, yeah, that kind of reminded me a lot of this situation here. And again, I don't fully have an articulate thought about what I'm trying to say, but I think that that was just something that always stands out to me.
Sure. I mean, again, I talked about being a Black teacher here, and you think that you've been hired, the school is somewhat progressive, they're going to understand some things. Mm-hmm. And then routinely you realize whether it be the Koreans or the white staff there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just don't.
It's a sad thing. Yeah. Did you have any more observations about either film, I guess, before you move on?
Let me go back to, I don't have much for Rox. I think I covered most of everything. I forgot about at the end of Malcolm X, Thomas Hagen, one of the shooters, was played by Giancarlo Esposito.
I know. I always like, well, I knew because I had seen the clip again, like during that Spike Lee event. I remember sitting there, I was like, huh? What?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, getting surprised again about that.
I think it's my first time seeing him on screen. Because I've never, I watched Breaking Bad for the first time last year. I mean, I watched like the first three episodes, like, I don't know, a couple years ago, but I just didn't get into it. But I committed to actually watching the whole thing like this time last year. And I watched, and I finally saw that performance of his, because I was influenced by his performance in The Boys, which was really great. So I was like, okay, let me see what he was about and this time. And so, but yeah, this was technically my first time seeing him on film.
I was quite surprised to see him at the end of Malcolm X as well. But also saddened, like when he gave his daughter the door, I was just like, just get out, just don't do this. Yeah, I felt very betrayed.
It's an emotional scene for sure.
It is. There was one more thing actually that I wanted to say about Rox, which was just so I chaired an event with Bookie Bakray, who's like who plays Rox, and something that interesting that she told me that came out of being on Rox was that she just talked about the experience of being on set and how that kind of widened her world of like what she could do in terms of a career. And her talking about like, you know, when they were doing like the auditions and like some of the other girls who were working on the set, that for them, because of the schools that they went to and like the areas that they grew up in, like the kind of be all like the most successful they could see themselves as was like working in an office and just having an office job and not realizing that there was like a bigger world outside of that. And I just thought, yeah, that was really interesting. And I think, as you know, I don't know if I still want to make films one day, but I think the whole process of this was something that I think was really interesting in terms of like bringing on young actors who didn't want to be actors necessarily and, you know, weren't going to drama school or anything like that, and kind of like showing them the different paths that there are out of there. And she kind of said like, you know, even for the girls who didn't want to continue acting, for them, you know, they started thinking about like, oh, maybe I could be like a lawyer, or maybe I could like, it doesn't just have to be working an admin job is not the cap for what I could do. And I think that's like a really beautiful thing to come out of the film.
I think to your point, like just the creation of the film, it felt accessible. Like they made this happen. They're not, you know, classically trained actors, but they made a compelling narrative and just made this happen. Like not anyone can be a movie maker, but it's possible to not, you know, have to be a Spielberg or whatever to make something really moving. So something I did note, it's just as you were talking about them as a teacher, watching them in the dance class was like, that's really cool. Like, I have goofy moments like that. I'll do crazy K-pop parties with my kid. But man, I thought about going home to be a teacher and just seeing them clown in that, was it at that cooking class?
Oh my God, yeah.
Like Korean kids, like that culture is just not here.
Yeah.
So the idea that I would be sitting among a bunch of adolescents just fighting and throwing, oh bro, I couldn't do it. I could not do it. So I feel for the West in regards to their struggles to control their kids.
Okay, moving on to I'm gonna say let's do music. So, I had a big like crisis about this when it came to picking a song, because I think, first of all, there's a lot of music that I missed as a child because I didn't grow up in London. I was quite sheltered and I had like immigrant parents. So like a lot of the things that I was listening to, I mean, I listened to a lot of music, but I listened to a lot of music shows, and a lot of them would showcase more music that was like across the pond and stuff. So I feel like I'm not the best judge when it came to picking a song that is like quintessentially Black British. And so there were like a few candidates. So I did have, this was a bit of a team effort when it came to finally picking a song. I was like, I asked Levi, I was like, I don't know, like what's the song that comes to mind when you think like, you know, something that's like very Black British? And I did actually know this song growing up, so this is not a complete cop out, but I picked 21 Seconds by the So Solid Crew. Which came out in 2001. I would have been 5 years old at the time, which is crazy. So the song is, So Solid Crew is a collective, I suppose, that mostly focused on like garage music. Garage. I really struggle saying garage. I don't know why.
Isn't that your pronunciation though?
Yeah, it is, but like I've been having this thing where I keep saying like elevator recently as well instead of a lift, and I'm like, what is going on? I think I'm like starting to become a bit like American. I don't know. All media that I'm watching is just like kind of crossing over. So
imperialism.
It's happening. But yeah, they made garage music and they were kind of like a collective. I think there's like about 30 confirmed members. Some of the members that you will know would be people like, well, if you watch Top Boy, you might know who Asha D is, who is one of the actors in Top Boy. And they basically, the history of the song, so I think it's less about the actual song and it's like lyrics, and more so about like the way that the song was created. But essentially their music label kind of told them that they needed to make a track that lasted 3.5 minutes, and the So Solid Crew is so massive that the MC Mega Man basically was like, okay, we're gonna divide the song up and see how many people we can get on this track. And that basically meant that each person had 21 seconds to drop a bar, and that's why the song is called 21 Seconds. And I think this is like one of the first songs that kind of it actually topped the UK singles chart, which I think was like quite monumental in terms of like Black British music being recognized amongst like the mainstream, and not being just like this kind of niche that you listen to on the radio. So that's kind of, yeah, that's the main reason that I picked it. It also, I think, you know, when you think about people like Asha D and other members of the So Solid Crew, of like this being kind of a precursor to the start of like grime culture, and like I think when I think like Black British culture, I think a lot about, I think music is probably like the thing that has kind of really emerged, especially in the last few years more globally, of like that actually being a thing of people listening to like drill, or like learning more about grime, and like listening more to like our rap artists. And then even if you think about like, you know, back in the day, like in the 80s, of thinking about like the sound system culture that we had, especially amongst like young Caribbean immigrants. So I kind of feel like this is almost like that middle point of, you know, all of that coming into the mainstream and then having grime and then now drill, which I don't love drill, but it's still, you know, kind of having this like evolved music and also moving away from like imitations of more African-American rap and like leaning a lot more into like our own sound and like what that sounds like. And even if other countries don't understand what we're saying, it doesn't matter because it still sounds sick.
I think that grabbed me immediately was you know, I think a lot of Black Americans kind of laugh at the UK about, you know, what do they know about the street struggles or like, you know, chip chip cheerio, governor, you know, it's like that, you know, it's like that kind of mockery. Yeah. But what immediately grabbed me about this, I know about future garage, like the electronic sound, like, you know, it's kind of closer to like dubstep-y. But when you said that garage genre, I didn't even register it. But for me, it was all about the BPMs because in 2001 in America, I'm looking at a list of the big songs right now. A lot of the songs were in such a lower BPM. You had like, I think the ones that I think everyone would know would be Who's That Girl? Who's That Girl? La, 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 la. You know, but like, but that's a lot slower than like, than 21 Seconds. Let's see. Wait, what else was a big one there? One Mic by Nas came out. Lap Dance by Nerd came out at that time. And so just as you said, this departure from African-American sound, like clearly very different. I don't even know. I'm trying to think also about just overall like the visuals of the video. Like it's like you're in a cage. I'm very curious. I would love to see a BTS about how that was created, like the green screen behind, there's cages out, and it's just kind of like this. And it almost felt Wu-Tang-y in a sense, but I don't think, because there's really only one, arguably two traditional, like handsome guys in the Wu-Tang Clan, you know, like Method Man is seen as like, you know, the hot guy. All the other guys are just like guys who just rap well. They're not like sex symbols, right? But this this crew, even just the name Soul Solid Crew sounds like a 1980s, like early 80s, late 70s name, right? Two Live Crew, Soul Solid Crew. It sounds very, just again, a big departure. Because like even Wu-Tang Clan sounds hard. Soul Solid Crew is like, okay, that's then you watch them and it's like these guys have like these ripped six packs and they are quite solid. You know, true to their name. So yeah, I thought that was all just very interesting to me.
Yeah, were there any other observations that you kind of had about the song or the music? I feel like with music it's hard to get like super into it, but like I'm just I mean, I think the observation that you made of like pulling up those comparisons actually of like other music that was coming out in 2001 was quite interesting to be like, oh yeah, that was like a full departure. Yeah. But I think
if y'all remember Ludacris, but roll out like that, again so slow compared to like this could, I feel like this Soul Solid Crew song could be played at like, you know, like a, like not a rave, but like, you know, like a different function. Like I don't, I'm playing it in my earphones right now. I'm trying to think like what is an American song, American rap song that would be at this BPM.
I would not know.
I don't know. I really don't know.
It's so, your homework.
Sure, it's so different. You know what? Let me just really quick. I want to Google the BPM of this song so I can maybe.
I think I have it up actually.
Okay, it is 137. So I guess technically, it is. Let's see. How can I describe it? It's like it is trap. You know, trap is around those BPMs. So technically, we could mesh it into something else. Like I think Bitch Don't Kill My Vibe by Kendrick, again, a slow song, is like 136 compared to 137 here, and I can't just cut that over into that, you know. Or you know, some Schoolboy Q, maybe Schoolboy Q, some Man of the Year, but I don't know, it just doesn't fit.
Also what you said about like the handsomeness of the members also like struck out, because I do remember even as a child I was like, that one's cute, but
they're like the Spice Boys, you know. Rap.
Okay, cool. Moving on to your music choice, why did you pick what you picked?
Umi Says.
My homie said, shine your light on the world. Shine your light for the world to see.
Man, I remember first seeing or hearing this song. There's a very famous Michael Jordan commercial where Michael Jordan is like, he's just sailing in the sky with like trying to dunk, and it's to this song. And you know, in the rap game, you know, I wasn't, you know, I'm not going to claim to be a big rap historian, you know, at that time, because this came out, I think that album came out in the year, was it 99 or 2000? I want to say it was 99. And so I wasn't actually really that big in rap at that time, but I saw those commercials, and it kind of cut my conservative brain about like what's possible in rap music. But to be fair, I didn't even know who Mos Def was. So I just thought he was just a singer. Like, that's all I knew. So to finally like really start to love rap, you know, a few years down the road, and pick that album up and hear the hard hitting lyrics of Black Star, and then go to Black on Both Sides. And then right in the middle of that album is this soft, tender tribute. And it's also, you know, we're talking about different parts of the diaspora. You know, Umi says that word Umi, like that's not a word that we as African-Americans use all the time. Mm-hmm. So he really like specifies where he's from, like his culture there. And so, you know, I thought about rap songs. I thought about a Black Star rap song, but I feel like this song was so introspective about how much pain he has, how much pain we all share, but also a sense of pride and a sense of hope to keep doing what needs to be done in your life. Mm-hmm. And in college, I had like a ton of playlists on my Creative Zen and my later iPod, but I had a Knowledge of Self playlist. It's corny, I know, but I had a bunch
you
of like
had my playlist title, so it's not corny.
Well, you know, I had a, you know, when I was like reading in college or studying, writing papers, you know, or just driving, walking around, and just wanted to get into that zone, I had a bunch of like college, you know, not conscious rap songs and stuff like that. So Blackalicious and Black Star was definitely in there. That song was definitely in there, and it definitely like always moved me. It always helped cheer me up, kind of like be like a guiding star if I was kind of falling off. And so when you challenged me to find a song, I was just like, I was going through a lot of songs, and then when I heard it, it just hit me that nostalgia of again, of pride and hope. And I was like, it's just this is the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt the same thing. I listened to it again with like a lyric video this morning, and it kind of reminded me of what I enjoyed about Rocks, I suppose, in a way, of just like having that, seeing and hearing about that pain, but also still having almost this like mantra to just like keep going on, and like him talking about like, I just want to see Black people succeed, and that kind of thing was just like in the background. And so it was like, I think that to me, if we go back to like thinking about like Black culture as a general term, is about, you know, some of the, maybe not joy, but like some of the things that come out of like this like struggle that we are in, like some of the mantras and like the music and like the fashion or the media, all of those kind of things that like come out of that. And I think also just like that callback to, you know, thinking about like your ancestors and like the things that maybe your parents have gone through, or like the things that your great grandparents have gone through, and like how you being here is like a product of like some of the struggles that they've been through, and like how you are almost like you are like just one chain in a long line of succeeding and like just continuing to push forward no matter how hard it gets. And I think there was something just really beautiful about that. Like, I really hate the phrase like, you know, you are your ancestors' wildest dreams. Not because of, I think I've made myself hate that phrase because I wrote a book where a character just talks about that. But that is the only time that I was like, oh yeah, like I kind of feel that, I don't know, that almost push. The song feels like a lovely gentle push where it's like, it's okay. Like, you know, we got you. Like, you're not on your own. Like, there is a collective around you, that sense of community.
Yeah, it's a warmth. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
On to our figures. I'm going to say that you go first because I decided to do a last minute change to my figure.
Okay. Like I said before, I was considering Bell Hooks. I've read more of her books than I have Cornel West, but I feel like I have a more personal connection to Cornel West. And I think no one at me in the comments. I'm not. I'll say of the books that I have read from her so far, there is nothing in the books that were uniquely American. I'll say that. That's what I mean. I'm sure she's written books about America specifically. But Cornel West, the book I read from him was Race Matters. He likens democracy to jazz in the sense of like all races and genders, et cetera, are different instruments, and democracy is playing together. But also, when a jazz musician does a solo, we all step back and let them have their time to shine. We don't, you know, try to, as you talked about with Malcolm X, be crabs in a bucket. We celebrate their talent and their voice, and then they step back and let someone else go up as well and speak. And I thought that was a uniquely American metaphor for what things should be. Yeah, with Race Matters, it was the first book I read on the Black experience that wasn't like a picture book about, you know, Malcolm, you know, Martin Luther King's biography. This was a serious book about the Black experience. And I read it when I was about, I think, 19. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very transformative time for me to, you know, again, being a minority on campus, which is very transformative for me in America, but also when I took it with me to Japan, because I took that book in my carry-on bag. And this is a crazy, I don't think I ever told you this story. As I said goodbye to my family and walking to the, whatever they're called, the terminal or whatever, I see this man in a suit, wild hair. And I thought to myself, this guy looks like a Cornel West impersonator.
Yeah.
And so just for jokes, I was like, hey, are you Cornel? And he finished my sentence, West. And I was like,
oh my God, that is crazy.
This is a true story. I was like a white girl at a Beatles concert. I was like, I flipped out. And I was like, oh my God, you're really him. I have my book in my bag right here. Yeah. I love your book. And I told him like, I'm about to go to Japan. It's my first time abroad. I'm blah, blah, blah. And just, he was listening to me. And just the excitement in his face for what I was about to do, who I was. I was just a nobody, but he was just so excited for me. It felt like I could have just believed in God right there. I was at that time an atheist, but man, I was like, is this divine intervention here?
Yeah.
See your philosophical idol right as you're going abroad for the first time. Mm-hmm. Lost my shit.
That is crazy. That was meant to be. Wow. Yeah.
He signed my book. We got a picture. I think I may have, you know, those are like the old disposable cameras. I don't think like it turned out okay. So that sucks. But yeah. And just incredible experience. So just that excitement, you know, whenever, you know, when like kids are like, hey, look at this. I made this. And I'm like, you know, and a lot of adults are just kind of like, oh, sure, kid, whatever. Mm-hmm. I try to get more excited for whatever my kids are excited about, whatever they talk about, because of that interaction with him.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the choices I've made for this show have just greatly influenced how I teach as well. That was a major moment for me.
Yeah. That's quite magical. Cause I think, that's cool. Cause they always say, don't meet your idols, but it's like quite nice when you do meet them and they're actually everything that you kind of, or at least within that moment, everything that you would want them to be. No, that's cool. I don't know why that's made me like so happy. I'm like, wow. Like, I feel like I didn't know who. I'm going to add that to my reading list actually now.
I mean, he's written a lot of books, but I think that's probably his most famous one. But I, you know, talking about him now, I want to read more of what he has written.
So the figure that I picked was, I kind of went around a lot. I wanted to pick a woman because I think, and I kind of say this in the intro, that I think growing up for me, there were a few like historical Black British figures that I did come to learn about as I grew up, but there is definitely an absence of like Black women or like named Black women in general. So I did really focus kind of on picking somebody who was a woman. And at first I kind of thought about Diane Abbott, who is an MP a Labour MP in Britain. And I think my interest with her is just like the position that she's in, but also the amount of abuse that she gets, like the amount of racist abuse. I think that's the tricky thing about being Black British sometimes, is like, it is that, you know, to quote, who's Du Bois, like that double consciousness kind of thing of like trying to fit these two identities. And I always am amazed at her like resilience, because I don't think I would be able to advocate for, I know she's doing this for like, you know, the wider Black community as well, comes into that, but like I don't think I could sit there in Parliament with people who actively, you know, are passing laws that like harm my community, and at the same time receiving all this like race mail and not getting support from all my, and I don't know, something about her resilience made me want to pick her. But I think after watching a few things this morning, I decided that I wanted to go with Doreen Lawrence instead. You know, there is like some similar veins there. So Doreen Lawrence is the mother of Stephen Lawrence, who was a young man who was murdered in 1993 by, at the time, unidentified white men. And it was a racially motivated attack. It was kind of, you know, well covered across the news and stuff. But essentially what happened was like the police completely mishandled the case, and his murderers were not found until 18 years after he had died, which is kind of, not ironic, but he was 18 at the time of his death as well. So, and his mother, Doreen, really put in a lot of work to make sure that his murderers were brought to justice. And not all of them have been tried, again, because of police incompetence. But because of this case and because of the advocacy and like activism that she's done, there was an inquisition that essentially happened where the police were accused of being institutionally racist, and that actually was like, you know, found to be true. And I think that's kind of like the first time that a lot of people in this country had heard of like institutional racism and actually had someone held to account for that. And I think that is like, the reason I picked this is because I think when we talk about like racism across, you know, the world, and when we kind of like compare stories like with friends that I have in America or like in other countries, we always talk about like how in Britain it is a bit more, less like in your face, which is not completely true. I think sometimes there are moments where it is very much in your face, but there is a lot more institutional racism. There is a lot more like that is very much like embedded in the system. And I know that's like the same again in like America, but I think that's like kind of
everywhere.
It's the same everywhere, but I think here like that is always like the talking point, I guess, that people come back to. And I think this was like a moment where, you know, people were able to be like, see we've told you, like this has been acknowledged in like on TV in court that this is what that was. And since then, Doreen has gone on to like do a lot of work, you know, in the name of her son. You know, there's now like a Stephen Lawrence Day, and like has really created a legacy out of something really tragic that happened, that has, you know, really changed the conversation that happens, that has had an impact in like the way that we talk about how Black men are like profiled, or like, you know, the way that we talk about like things like knife crime, and has done a lot of work around that. And so I think, again, it is that thing of like creating something good out of something very painful. Institutional racism as a term was not something that we had really like grappled with before. And I think now that everyone has had this as an example, it's kind of opened up a conversation that maybe previously was not as easy to have, where, you know, you felt like you were being gaslit all the time. There's a really interesting interview that I was kind of watching, which was quite hard to watch because it was Doreen kind of talking about, you know, the whole Stephen's murder and like the night that, you know, she found out, and like the whole process of doing what she had to do. And a lot of people always say to her like, oh, you're so strong, like, you know, you've done all of this kind of stuff. And her answer in that particular interview was just like, you know, I think everyone has that in them where if you are put in this situation that you will do what you need to do to make sure that someone is brought to justice. And her just thinking about like future generations and other people's young Black sons who this could have happened to. And yeah, I think that the kind of work that she's done has also meant that Stephen is not has not been forgotten, even though it's been, you know, over 30 years that he is still in the public consciousness, and that what happened to him didn't go unpunished. She's like a figure that I think about often, I suppose, because I think of, like, you know, I think it's that idea of resilience and not letting the system, like, just break you down into, like, just accepting things for what it is and actually fighting back and actually naming things.
Before we, like, stop here, I wanted to, because you were talking about, you know, resilience and stuff like that. And so when I thought about my encounter with Cornel West, I've been thinking about, you know, last year was not my best year. And mm-hmm. so I also had trouble with resilience. And I came across this James Baldwin quote recently that says, those who say it can't be done are usually interrupted by others doing it. And for Cornel West, he has a quote in his book about nihilism. I don't know how it's pronounced. I think both are fine, but it says, like alcohol and drug addiction, nihilism is a disease of the soul. It can never be completely cured, and there is always the possibility of relapse. But there's always a chance for conversion, a chance for people to believe that there is hope for the future and a meaning to struggle. Nihilism is not overcome by arguments or analyses. It is tamed by love and care. So just to leave that with the community out there, your listeners, one of my resolutions this year is to get more connected with my community wherever I am. So I hope you all also follow suit.
I think that's a beautiful way to end, actually. I had a question, but I'm going to leave it there, because I think if I was like forced to define Black culture, I think that would probably be the term that I would want to use, of just like thinking about community and like finding your community and finding joy and finding resilience. And yeah, I'm happy to be part of that community across all borders and kind of continue to contribute. I think, yeah, that's like a similar thing that is a resolution for me this year, of just like doing more and being more present and not letting the weight of the world kind of make me isolate myself, because that's not useful to anybody. But yeah, that's been an episode. I feel like we have a reading list. I'm going to put up a reading list, because I feel like we talked about a lot of things this episode, and I think it would be useful for people to kind of explore like some of the things that we were talking about in depth themselves and kind of form their own opinions. So I will post that somewhere. It's been really great having you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Nerd Alternative. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a rating and a review. You can find more of us on Twitter at The Nerd Alternative without the E after the N, Instagram and TikTok at The Nerd Alternative, as well as our YouTube channel. Peace out until next time.